So, welcome to dispatching method calls, Mark 2. And we're going to start right from the very beginning of programmers' days, so to say. So, the most ancient thing that is of importance here is probably how the naive way of dispatching method calls or procedure calls or function calls or whatever was done. So I've dug quite deep into history and found the old ANSI C standards from 89. And you see it's already gone moldy and a little bit rugged and all that. However, the principles are still there in present time C. So what's going on there? Well, what you did back in those days was that you could, you would identify the targets of the code that you would call by just calling it by name. So, in this case, if you would call fun, you would directly dispatch to this one. Could have multiple parameters, so that wouldn't matter, so that would dispatch to this one. And you could also assign one variable with another thing. It's probably, well, there's still a bug in there, so it's not like this. You cannot reuse this kind of name by just assigning it a new value. You would have to introduce a new variable of that, of the type function pointer, but yeah. So that was what you could do in ANSI C. There were a few oddities involved. For example, if you would find a function like this one over here with no parameters, it was actually legal to call it with one or several parameters or even vary in the types of the parameters, it would nevertheless all would dispatch to just the same function that you had over there. So that's a little bit of an oddity for you. And well, if you wanted to do something a little bit more in a kind of nice way, so that you would kind of try to create bundles of procedures that would all serve the same purpose and you would like to call them with the same name. Well, turns out that that is something that is not legal. You cannot provide several functions of the same name with just different parameters. So for something like this very old ancient ANSI C, that's the end of the game, so you cannot do anything more than just singletons in your name, and you wouldn't care about the types of the parameters or anything else. So that was how you would do procedure calls in C for a long, long time. In the meantime, there have been a lot of other concepts arisen from the ashes, and there was the idea of overloading function names, reusing the same function names for different implementations. In most cases, you would try to specialize your function for particular parameter types. And after 22 years, this also came to the C world in a certain specific form, just an extension of the language capabilities. So in something like C11, you would have a new way of constructing expressions with this generic selection thing. So that's this part over here. You are now allowed to start an expression with this keyword generic. And this is a multi-part expression, which would have, first of all, a certain expression given. And that is an expression that the compiler would take and would analyze for its type. So the compiler would determine the static compile time type of the expression that you would use here. And after it has done that, it would go through the through this generic association list. What's that? This is just a list separated with commas, so far nothing special here. And it would be of the following form. It would have pairs of, at the one side, type name, and on the other side, a special expression. So the purpose of that would be to match the type of the expression that was given to the generic expression in the first part, and to return the expression that is mentioned in the particular clause that matches the type of the foremost expression. And in case that there's nothing that matches, you also have the possibility to just match with a default case. Something like that. It's now possible to have special constructions like the ones that you see here that already remind us of of overloading functions. So now it's possible to do things like this println function, which would be kind of usable for several different types of parameters. And how it's realized is, in this case, it's a lot of preprocessor hacking. So what is done is that I want to map this println function call to the printf function in a specific way. So in the end, we will end up with printf at some point, and we will give the parameter to this printf. And as you know, if you have programmed C a lot in your time, is that you need also a descriptor string for the format of your data that you want to print out. And that is something which is which comes by this new generic selection expression, which is inside of this printf macro. This printf descriptor format macro expands to our new expression, this generic keyword, and it would take its parameter as an argument and would match with, in this case, I have abbreviated a little bit. You could, of course, match with a lot of others here, but I have just chosen this the integer or float as a type, and it would, in these cases, return either the format string for just the integer or the float. Of course, that's not complete here, but we've only limited room on the slide. So in this case, it would just return the appropriate format string, and in the end, we would then also add the print the new line printer. So. It's in the this one here. I'm actually not completely sure why you have to do so. I think the preprocessor is for me a little bit of a magical thing, so I've never thought about the how to use it. It was just for security reasons that you not for security, but for being sure that it would capture the right. Think so. I'm not completely sure why this is there. I have not really looked into the preprocessor. By chance, is there anyone who really has a lot of experience with this preprocessor and C stuff and knows why there's the brackets?
In this case, an expression.
So in that
have this case, X might contain comma, so it will break everything without brackets.
Ah, that's what. That's not, of course. Yeah, that would be a sensible thing. Yeah. Hmm? Okay. Good. Okay. So far, that was one extension to kind of cheat the whole C system into looking like it would have something like overloading of function. However, you see, it's just a little bit of a preprocessor magic and compile time rewriting together with a new construct for accessing accessing the types from within the language. So there's a little bit of a reflection inserted into C with that. So yeah. Anyway, it looks a little bit more pretty than before, I would say. But let's have a look at the real deal. So in this kind of object-oriented languages, there is the concept of overloading that probably a lot of people have already experienced. So the deal here is, well, you would be able to specify several functions with the same name. So this F is here twice. And at one point, it's with a double as a parameter, and at one point with an integer. So there's two versions of it. And depending on what kind of parameter you would use, it would go to the right one by some magical way. So there's here the kind of experiment where we set up a call to f with an integer and a call to f with a float. And surprise, surprise, what it does is, well, it will just give the appropriate answers to us. So first it's going to the integer version. The second, it's going to the double version. So nice so far. Java is a language which also supports that you inherit the functions that you have specified in your ancestor to your subtype. So D is inheriting the function definition of f as an integer over here. So in this case, well, we once again have the same setup with f calling 2 and f calling 2.3. What we'll get here is this thing. For those of us who have learned to program Java, that probably doesn't come as a big surprise. However, I was always assuming that would be the common base, but it seems that that's not something that is realized in that way in every object-oriented language. We will see that later on. So there's a few complications that arise from this kind of system. For example, the version that you see here. So we have two declarations of f here, which clearly differ in the sequence of parameters that we have. And now, well, let's try to call them in this case. So is there any idea what will happen?
Yeah.
Where will be the error? So I think with that you're already pointing to the right thing. The error is here in that spot. So it's completely legal to declare those two. So that was what I wanted to kind of query for. So it's okay to specify them like that for the compiler. The problem is when there's a call site which is ambiguous. In this case, you will get something that I don't know whether... Has anyone gotten this error message before? Ah, okay. You must have written a lot of code. Okay, yeah, of course, yeah, it has the same system. Yeah. But anyway, you must have written a lot of C++ then. Okay, so, yeah, that's, yeah, please. Yeah, it also it turns out that well, int is kind of a subtype of double. So in type theory, you have to think in this subset relations in types. So if you talk about integers, you have kind of a set of all the integers, and they are a subset of all the floats. Well, not really in machine language, but in type theory, those would be subsets, and that's also what the casting does in these cases.
Can we have another overloading of f with two arguments, both int? Would Java be so clever that it just takes the third opportunity with both ints?
That is a nice question, and I think we should have a look in. Yeah, we will come to that in a few slides, but. Keep that in mind.
If you have the same function call but with two doubles instead of two floats, instead of two integers, will it be able to solve?
So, what would you say? You just don't know, or do you have a suspicion?
Suspicion would do the same.
Yeah.
Like, double is not a subset of
integers. Yeah, because, yeah, that's so the integers. Well, are more special, are kind of the subtypes to the doubles. So inserting the version with two doubles would not solve the problem in any way, because there's still it would prefer to dispatch to the method which is more appropriate for my types, in the sense that it has narrower types. And yeah, the one with two doubles would be more general,
so to say. Between the order of your parameters.
Hmm?
It doesn't differentiate between
orders. No, it doesn't evaluate the sequence in some way. So that's not, well, not in this case. But there might be systems out there which do so. But yeah, not in this case. So for overloading, we are talking about. Static dispatching. So how are methods that are in doubt of how to dispatch to a static way actually dispatched? So what you have is, at one side you have the call expression, which is this one, and on the other hand you have your collection of declared methods, which have a certain return type, T0, and parameter types, T1 to TN. And the question is now, you need to find the declared method to which your method call is dispatched to, or which handles your method call. And that is something that has to do with the signature of your method call, with the static types of the actual parameters. Instead of static, you always have to think about compile time types. So static is kind of the synonym, in this case, for compile time. What is determined by such a function call is the compile time types of at least your parameters, and in some situations also the type of your return value. And it's now a matter of whether the declarations of your methods are applicable to the compile time signature of the call that you have issued there. So that is what is happening here. We have a function call which has to be processed. We have a signature which comprises, first of all, of course, the function name, then the static types of the parameters, and also the return type in a few cases. And we have concrete methods as candidates for calling targets, and we have to find a certain type of matching, which we call the applicability relation, or whether a certain candidate is applicable to a certain particularly found compile time signature of a function call. And the way that this is handled is by checking for subtypes. So the procedure candidate F is applicable to the a function call F prime if, so to say, F is a subtype of F prime in the sense of the typing rules, which means that if we interpret this subtype relation with, well, I don't know, has anyone not had compiler bow yet? Or compiler construction in this case? Okay, so yeah, there you would have gotten the, what the actual subtyping rules would incorporate. Well, if a function is a subtype of another function in terms of type theory, if the parameters, the formal parameters of your first functions are actually more general than the types of the second function. So I should probably use different colors here. No, where is it? So these are the ones from here, and the red ones are the ones from here. And for the return type, it's the other way around. So the return type of your subtype must also be a subtype of the return type of the more general type. So the return types are behaving the same way as the function in terms of specialization or subtype relation. And the parameter types are behaving in an inverted way. So they contradict this subtype relation.
Should these functions have the same number of parameters?
Yes. Yeah. Otherwise, this. Yeah. Yeah. So that's something that I haven't put on there. So what was interesting for me in this case was this the subtype relations between the parameters. So what does that mean for our static dispatching? Well, we can legally dispatch to a certain provided function if I have to check this one here for the types of the parameters, and F is a valid candidate for handling our calling expression F prime if the parameter types of our candidate this are more general than the types of the actual parameters in the procedure call. So that's what you can read from that. I will back that up in the next few slides. There's the excerpts from the internals of the Java C compiler. So you can get that as open source and check it for what's actually in there. And the particular procedures or functions that are called in the compiler when translating from source code to bytecode actually have functions that are called with the same terms as they are in the language standard. They are called this is applicable, and they do exactly this thing. They perform is more specific checks in there for each of the arguments and compare the the member definition to the type of the actual arguments. So the types of the actual arguments are in this args array, and the types of the function definitions are in this M, and they have to be extracted. I think it's over here, so you get them into this M args, and they then end up here. So they're compared with this is more specific, and in case that the one of the one of the actual arguments of the actual parameters is not more specific or is more general than the type of the argument of my candidate, then the method will yield no, it's not applicable. So that's how you have to read that. I'm kind of trying to abbreviate this parsing of this code a little bit for you, but if you don't get it so fast, you can review that still at home. So that's the is applicable relation in code. To say, it just needs to be clarified what this is more specific is actually doing, and there's a lot of these instances themselves overloaded for different basic types. So this is more specific forks to particular implementations for basic types, as well as one implementation for, once again, the if you compare to function calls. So that's the one that I've given you over there. But yeah, anyway, so these are these two basic concepts that you have in the compiler. There's this notion of being applicable to something, and there's this notion of being more specific than something. And turns out that when you try to translate something like such a method call, what you get is you will at the compiler will at some point call the match method function, which will end up in a loop over all the function definitions, which are inside this member methods. They will be queried for the particular method name that was. Okay, that was not what I wanted. So this method name is queried, and all the methods that come back from there are then went through one by one. And what you then do is you try out whether the method that you found is applicable to your argument types. If not, then it's not a candidate in any way. But if so, what you do then is you keep it as a likely candidate in a certain variable that is called this tentative variable. You keep it in there in case that you haven't found any appropriate calling target so far. But if you have found one so far, then it is already in this tentative, and you have to then clarify whether the method that you have found in this go of the loop, whether this one is more specific than the one that you have found so far. And if so, you take the new candidate as your tentative candidate. And also what you do is you keep a candidate list of all the ones that are themselves in some way also more specific than the you check whether the two versions that you found so far as the tentative and your new candidate, when both of them are not more specific than the other, then you have found one of these situations that you have had in the last few slides, where you had this conflict between this pair int double and double int. In these cases, none of them would be more specific than the other. And if that happens, you will add that in a certain list. And in the end, when you have run through all the method candidates for your method call, and you've come up with a tentative one, you rerun through the list of candidates that you have found so far, and in case that you have still one in this list that is cannot be more dominated in the sense of being more specific, then you have this ambiguous situation where you just throw your ambiguous member exception, which will end up in your compiler saying that at that point you have an ambiguous call. So that's what's actually happening in there. And now you have had your question. Could we have resolved the situation by introducing a new function definition with int in there? Didn't Yeah. So in, with the int, it depend. Of course, it depends on how the sub subtype relation is between int and double. So that's probably why these two versions came up. Well, you have to provide the one that clearly dominates both of the or all of the other candidates in terms of specificness, specialization, probably, and. If you have specified such one, such a method, then you can be sure that your method call will find one unique, most specific match for your method call and will dispatch to this one. Okay, so it is resolvable by inserting the correct method with the correct types, but yeah. You have to find the to dominate all the parameters in terms of being more specific. Good. So that's how Java does it. Turns out that there's several ways to solve this whole thing, especially with this specific situation where you inherit from an ancestor at some place. So probably people will now think, especially if they come from the Java direction, well, that's just the same thing. I know C++ has a little bit of a different syntax, but in principle, we see here the same example as we have a few slides ago. So what will come out of that? Well, unluckily, it doesn't do the same. It doesn't actually yield int here, and also doesn't yield the three that we would have expected as a Java programmer over here. So that's probably why a few of the confusions of the slides last time came from, because, well, turns out that you have to do something different in C++ to achieve the same thing as Java does. Java by default iterates through all the ancestors in order to find the most specific match for your method call. That's something that you have to manually insert into the class body for something like C++. So I don't know whether you've realized the difference or spotted the difference here. So this one, you have to add this using clause to your subtype in C++. So for the C++ guys, Java does that automatically. For the Java guys, C++ needs to be annotated for that. So yeah, that's probably clearing a few of the misunderstandings last time. So moving on. Overwriting methods. What's that all about? Well, that's now in the... Yes, please?
One question about the previous slide.
Yeah.
What if we have in BAT, for example, two functions, and so for example, int I and char c, f from char c, so what should be right in D, to use both functions?
That's a good question. I'm actually not so deep into that, so hmm. So you don't do any more precise declaration of what you're gonna import with that.
I don't even know if you can.
Any experienced C++ programmers here who know about that? The thing is, assume that we have another one over here with char C, for example. And now the question is, what does this one refer to? Does it mean that I now have imported or included both of these into my scope, or is it yielding some kind of ambiguous specification for this thing here, or what is the actual behavior? Probably we can try it out. I'm not so much of a C++ expert to be able to answer that. That's something that I had to look up, and I was assuming to work similar to Java, so yeah. From that you can probably see that I'm coming from the Java direction, not from the C direction. Yeah. Okay. So it's not clear to me what's happening in this case. Maybe it will consider the parent class for any for any queries related to the name F. I'm not sure, but that's just an uneducated guess from my side. I see people pulling out their laptops, but. Yeah, maybe it will be a delayed answer. Anyway, we should probably continue because we already have the evaluation going. So, overwriting methods. So that's the next best thing here. Object orientation has not only brought us something like overloading of functions, but also a kind of different concept or different approach to procedures, which are now seen as methods. And what's special of a method? Well, the way that I've found that is that before you would conceptually do something like, I should have probably put struct over here, you would have defined methods like these ones, which would have a few parameters and then would have worked on that. And as soon as you go over to something like object orientation, you would, instead of having functions or procedures floating around in the void and doing for themselves, instead you would always try to associate one particular class to be, or an object of a specific class to be responsible for or associated with that specific particular function. So as, for example, in this case, where I try to model my natural class, and what I would provide is, for example, an increase by method that would take a natural and increase its value by a certain integer value. And yeah, the way that I would do that in object-oriented world would be that I would not provide an external method for that, but I would, or external procedure for that, but instead I would provide a method which would miss one of its parameters, namely the first one, this natural one, and that's the one that we would associate that method with now. Why is that? Well, first of all, we have written the method body now into the body of the corresponding class. So that's the first sign. The second sign is that we have an implicit new keyword, this, which would act as kind of the identifier which is bound to this former first parameter. So what has beforehand has been this first parameter is now called this and typed by the type that we have from the class body. And yeah, but all in all, it's still handled as kind of a parameter. It just comes implicitly with each of these calls. And before, what we had to do was we had to explicitly call the method with a first parameter. And now what we do is we pronounce that we treat the first parameter in a very special way by just pulling it out of the parameter list to the very front of my procedure call, and that's what we do to emphasize that the method is supposed to be associated quite closely to this specific object and its type. Okay, the exciting thing then for object orientation is that you have this subtyping where you can extend your certain types step by step and only specify the deltas or the differences between these bodies, and this has certain implications on the methods now. So suppose we have this integral type, which is for integral numbers. Of course, we have the Java integer, but let's put that aside for a moment. So we specify our type with an increase by that just puts the delta onto our internal data value. And for the natural, we are more careful. We provide a more specific method, which is only for naturals. And in this case, what we do is we will only add the absolute value of the parameter onto this. So we have different implementations for different types. And the subtype has a more, so to say, more special implementation as the more general type. So what you can do then is, of course, you can instantiate your base type, you can instantiate your subtype, but what you can also do is you can assign the subtype to a variable which is typed with your base type, and then the question is now what's happening when you try to call the method that the type for this I is clearly offering. So this I is typed with integral, and integral is clearly offering an increase by thing. But now the question is, what should you do? And the basic concept for our object orientation in this approach is that the system would dispatch the call not to the to the implementation candidate that would have been chosen by the static dispatcher, but instead it would call the target that at runtime is offered by, well, looking into the type, the runtime type of the variable on which we would call, and we would choose the method from there. So we would implicitly call the specialized method. That sounds a little bit difficult here. Back to the diagram that you've seen before. That's what so far. That's what static dispatching was. Now that we do dynamic dispatching, we add a little bit, which is this kind of runtime specializer. And this handles method calls in object-oriented systems by at runtime dispatching to the corresponding method. So what's how can we implement something like that? Well, let's have a look at what Java does in that case, because, well, I'm always taking this Java things because you can actually access the compiler in this case and also have a look at what the runtime does. So that's why it's all Java here. So anyway, let's have a small example program, which is doing just the compressed form of what you've seen before. It instantiates a new natural as an integral and then increases or calls the increase by, which is overwritten in our subtype. And let's have a look at what does what's that doing. And in the first part, what's running is the Java C compiler. This Java C is capable of doing all the compile time checks and the compile time generations and all the stuff that's statically done. So in the first part of this whole system, what we get is we get a static dispatching here. So the thing that it's creating can be seen here. That's Java bytecode disassembled. So we see the assembly. That's what the Java C produces. And what we can clearly see is that we get, well, first a lot of noise, which has to do with creating the appropriate object of type natural and then storing it somewhere, reloading it, pushing the parameter of 42 on there, and then in the end we would then issue our call, which is this invoke. All the calls in the JVM are actually invokes in some specialized name. So also, function names are never in plain text in the code itself. It's always some kind of reference to a string table where we can see the what is associated with a certain number. So in this case, I have my special function number 6 here, and it can be read from the string table that this is the method integral inc by with an integer as a parameter. So what we see here is that in the first part where only the Java C has run, we have actually gotten a static analysis on the thing, which has tried to statically infer the identity of the call target, which is in this case this integral inc by with an int. So that is just the this analysis with inferring all the compile time types for the parameters, which includes also this receiver thing, which has been pulled out of the thing. So that's this part. For that, we also had the static type inferred. And what we get now is that we have a special invoke here, which is an invoke virtual. Turns out that we haven't had a look at what calls that are not virtual are translated to. Turns out that there's invoke static also, which would just do a plain static call. But for ordinary methods which are not static, you always get this invoke virtual. So now the question is, what does that invoke virtual mean? And for that, we have to look into the runtime. So these two separated two phases. There's the static or compile time phase, which does static analysis and static dispatch. And then there's the runtime system of the object-oriented world, which does the virtual dispatching. So it's not ending right here. It's going further. Let's have a look at what the hotspot virtual machine actually does. And turns out you have to debug a lot, and I've done that with people in the tutorial sessions last year, and we were desperately lost in the depths of the hotspot VM. So you have to debug really a lot, and in the end, you get that at some point the hotspot VM will call, which is in C or C++, so you have to be able to read that, which will then call this resolve method, which is, yeah, I've annotated it with a lot of comments here, but I once again try to just highlight you the relevant spots, because otherwise we will be here tomorrow. So, yeah. So all in all, what is relevant here is this second part. So the other things are not interesting here. So inside the resolve method, we will have here a lookup method in classes call, which is so that's the fork for just our problem, where we want to look up class relevant dispatching, and we give it the resolved method, which is this with this static information and the resolved class and the method name and the method signature. So that's all that this gets, and what it does is it will then this is what lookup method then does. It's a for loop, and it loops over can you imagine what that is? That's a linked list with the super classes as the links between our list. So we will try to go along the super chain of our class through the list of classes that are associated with my object here, and in there we will then try to find the method that matches my specific signature with my specific name. So I'm going through the superchain list from the class that corresponds to the runtime type of my object that I found so far. And what do I do inside the find methods? That's once again a lot of code. And essentially, well, you might recognize that if you have been in one of the introductory courses so far. It's this kind of, it's just performing It's just performing a binary search. So in there, it does a binary search for the corresponding name of the methods, and then goes through all the names that. That match the name that we are looking for, and tries to match the signature. So, what we have in the runtime system is then, opposed to the compile time, where we only had the static or compile time type of my expression as the basis of which we could work, we now have the concrete objects class, because, well, you can at runtime just read from the object which class it is, and then you reach your most specific class that's associated with your thing that you get from creating your object, and then you can go through the super fields back to the through the whole hierarchy of classes that corresponds to your type. And while you go through that backwards until you reach the object, you will look for an entry that matches your signature and your name. And the signature that you're looking for there is the static signature that you've found. So, yeah, that's what's happening in there. So we have these two parts, which is at one time the compile time, with Java C that does the static dispatching and tries to statically find the most specific method that matches your call types. Yes?
Can you go back to the previous one? According to the code, I think that it just returns the first method that it finds.
Yeah. Because it's looking for the exact match of the signature. But that's the runtime here. So that does not do any most specific comparisons anymore, and it can do so because the only most specific thing that you have to match now is for the runtime type of your specially treated first parameter that corresponds to the receiver type, which is the type of the object that you found there at that point. So you get that implicitly by running through your inheritance chain from your most specific type to back to the most general type. So you don't need to consider any duplicates in there, and also there won't be any duplicates in there anymore because you cannot specify. Well, the compiler will not allow duplicates of methods in there. So, well, at least that was the case until Java 8, I think, when they started with the default methods, but it's a completely other thing. So let's just keep it as simple as that. So, for one part, you have this search for the most specific method via Java C, which is just static considerations of your types. Then you have the hotspot VM, which runs a search through your type chain from most specific to most general, and looks for an exact match of the signature that has been associated with the call in the static part of the compiler. So that's the thing that you've seen last time in the lecture, in Mark 1 of the slides. So now we're kind of back to where we've been before. And you see here, this is the example where overwriting actually didn't work, because now we know what's actually happening. When we are inside this set implementations, the set at one point doesn't know about the concrete type of what's going in there at the time when it is written and compiled. So the compiler for the hash set's implementation of whether something should be added or not, at some point does a comparison, conceptually at least, of object 1 and object 2. And it cannot assume anything special about the runtime type or the type of the parts that we have here. So everything it has is assuming that this is at some point an object. So when trying to find a candidate to which to dispatch to, the static part of the analysis, which is the compiler, tries to only to assume that the first thing, which is the receiver of the thing, is of type object, and thus it assumes that the signature for that thing is, well, that's not intelligent to use. So it will be, the first type is object, then it will have the name equals, and the second part will also be an object. And that's what it's going to dispatch to. So in bytecode, you will find a call to a signature like that. And in order to get something like polymorphic calls, which was this overwriting feature that we wanted to use, we would have to, in the natural, we would have to provide a method that can vary in this receiver's type, which it would for the natural, of course. But apart from that, we need to be exact in the rest of our signatures. So this needs to be object in order for dynamic dispatching to recognize this as a valid calling target for that sort of thing. So that's not a valid target for overwriting or for polymorphic calls here, or at least not based on this signature. So that's why this thing doesn't work. You have to keep attention to the exact signature that you use for these things. So, yeah, that's the one that we have gone through last time. I'm gonna do that not again. This time I have patched it so that we actually have so that we actually have one method that's really overwriting the version of its ancestor. So in these cases, yeah, you will see that this call will actually at some point call the overwritten method. As we have discussed about that last time already, I don't want to go through all that again. We will do so in 1 week's time on Thursday. There's a lot of other questionnaires with just these very likable Java codes, and yeah, we will have a lot of fun with that, I hope. Anyway, let's continue on. The next best thing to single dispatching is multi-dispatching. So what's that all about? Well, you have seen this faulty example with the equals and with parameter natural, and that was something that we clearly want to have at some point for certain purposes, probably not strictly for this natural, but at other occasions. So what we could do is, in case that our language has something like introspection or some other way of getting to know what the types are, we can try to hardwire that with an instance of. So that's probably what's actually happening right. Well, you're I can understand your what do you call that? Nose? Yeah, the frowning. But that's what's at the moment actually happening, because we don't have anything other than that in language. We can try to be creative. Well, that works, but that burdens us with type safety ourselves, and we have to make sure that we always offer an alternative, and there's no support in the compiler for what we want to do here at all. So yeah, that's bothersome and repetitive and yeah, quite a burden, and it's only there for languages which have something like type introspection. So we could try to be creative and do something with generics. So we could introduce, for example, this equalizable interface that's parametric in the in a certain type, which we want to use at the equals, for example. And we could specify, or could want to specify, our natural as being equalizable with other naturals, and then just use natural as the parameter type over here, and hope that that will work. So has anyone already tried to do something like that? Well, one thing I have not mentioned probably is you would also have to make your set being aware of this interface equalizable in order to try to come up with something different than this O equals O, where O is always of type object. With when you are aware of this equalizable thing, you can require that all the things that you put into your set fulfill this this interface. And if it's parameterizable with a type T, you can hope that this will then dispatch to T dot equals T and solve your problem here. But turns out, bugger all, our Java is not supporting the generic types at all levels in our implementation, specifically when we compile down our methods that are written with that are written with our specialized type over there. The system will nevertheless do something which is called type erasure and get rid of all the things that we have parameterized so far, and will instead work with the most basic type that is base type to everything. So it will revert back to object, and yeah, So the thing that we want to have here doesn't even compile, because the equals t that we have specified would boil down to the same thing as the equals object already is when we do our type erasure and defeated by legacy supporting compiler here at this point. So that's also not a solution here. Yeah? Backwards compatibility was the only thing, but let's see. It's just practical reasons, nothing more important. Of course. So, apart from that, that was what we would do in practice. Anyway, there's been concepts of more advanced stuff already out there, which is called this multi-dispatching. So the idea here is that that's the model that we have with single dispatching over here. We would just try to extend it and support that we are able to specialize at dynamic dispatching, not only for just the first parameter, but for all the parameters. How would something like that work? In this case, the dispatcher, meaning the runtime, would then, and that's where your question comes in. In this case, now that we have several parameters, we now need our dispatcher to search for the most specific concrete candidate that would match the runtime types of our parameters. So we extend the thing that we had beforehand with our single dispatching to not only dispatch based on the type of the receiver, but also on the type of all my parameters. So there's a lot of implications that has on the implementation. First of all, type checking is a little bit more difficult here if you want to filter out a few of dangerous situations. Type checking on families that are all dispatched based on the same static signature now has to actually check whether there is a unique, most specific methods for all the different combinations of parameters out there in this case, or well, you can also leave that away and let it crash if it crashes. But in principle, when you have type support, you can do such types of checks in there. And also, multiple inheritance might introduce new ambiguities if you inherit from different sources. Methods that would kind of compete in this search for the most concrete specific implementation of something, and that creates a lot of nasty special cases that are not so nice in practice. However, apart from that, for code generation purposes, this specialized methods can be just created separately from each other, just with some kind of special suffix or prefix or whatever you decide on, which cannot be created from a program itself. And what you would then do, you would by hand, for example, implement such a dispatcher. You could just do that in a kind of pre-processing phase of on your source code, or enhance the virtual machine with a dispatcher. And we could even create it from just the from the compiler part and create it into your bytecode, and then let it dispatch on runtime. And yeah, what it would have to do, it would have to do all the type checks for you, and then fork to your special implementation of the method. Yeah, so that's what would happen. And performance-wise, all that would come all that would happen there was that there are a few instance of tests in case that there actually are several versions of your methods, and if not, then there wouldn't be any instance of tests, so it's not so really not a large punishment on your runtime. So there has been extensions on, for example, Java with multiple inheritance, with multiple dispatching, and it looks like that. This natural problem that we had a few slides ago, you could happily encode in the way that you would specify the signature of your method a little bit differently. You would say that you would specialize this method call for the type natural in this case, instead, but you would dispatch based on object being the type here for the parameter. So all calls that the Java runtime would issue with the static type object as a parameter would have to be checked for whether the concrete runtime type of the parameter would really match with natural. And if so, then this body would have to be executed. That would be the meaning of the whole thing. Yeah. Actually, the compiler itself would perform a similar thing on this specifically emphasized first parameter that actually is the receiver thing. But we have to have a different form of expressing that, because we can only include our implementation in one of these class bodies. So there's no chance to also incorporate the same method body in another classes body. So that just doesn't make any sense. So there's also ways to, because it doesn't make any sense to emphasize the first parameter anymore if you have multiple dispatching. That's why this multiple or multi-Java implementation also offers to pull out the whole declaration of your method from the class body, and instead you could also declare something like equals object at natural object at natural, like this. So that's kind of a normalized version of specifying that. Anyway, with that, the system will generate for you the appropriate calls to everything, and for that it would, that's fifth time today, it would generate a dispatcher, which would wait behind the curtains of equals on object, and this would fork based on the type of the parameter, and it would fork to an equals implementation with natural as parameter or an equals implementation with object as a parameter, depending on what the actual type of the parameter was, and that is something that is checked by this checkcast instruction in the bytecode. So that's what is happening behind the scenes. So this is a solution that just enhances the first part, this compiler, so that it emits bytecode that has just such a dispatcher hard-coded. Okay. And this redirects. So we can terminate with natively multi-dispatching languages, because you might now be interested in whether that's something that has made it into languages that are out there in practice. And yeah, everyone's favorite, Lisp. Don't know whether you have encountered that already. There's a dialect of Lisp which is called Clojure, which is implemented for the JVM, and it's a dialect of Lisp. And yeah, we don't have so much time, but I will just shortly show you how that is implemented in there. So there's a lot of conventions in there. I will go over them. You can have a look at them at home. And what is offered you from Clojure is that you can explicitly define methods as being multiply dispatched with such a def multi keyword. You have the different candidates to which to dispatch to with this def method, which dispatch based on the same function name over here. And the thing is that for such a multiple dispatching system, you also need to provide the resource on which to dispatch, which can be done by defining an appropriate function here. And this one is a very simple implementation over here. And it says that the function, which is supposed to have two parameters, is dispatching exactly on the identity of the relevant parameters, or the particular parameters, which means that, well, this method is supposed to be called on data that can be either child or parent. And if I call it with child, then I will just finally take this parameter and say, and if it is child, then I will execute this thing, which is a method parametric in A and B, and all that it does is it returns the string child equals. So I didn't put a lot of effort into doing something very intelligent in this implementation. The only thing that I wanted to show you is that you have a dispatching function you can customize on what you actually want to dispatch here. And I've done a few more examples here, which do a more elaborate thing. Here I wanted to kind of simulate what the natural example actually was all about. So I've introduced kind of composed data types for natural and object, and for that I would give the opportunity to query the structure for whether it is a natural or an object by just giving it an accessor, which is called class in this case. And now what I do for my multiple dispatching method is, for the method that actually does the dispatching, I would say that I would dispatch based on what my accessor class yields when I access class inside of the first parameter or on the second parameter. And in case that both of them turn out to yield natural, then I would fork to my specialized version, which would do the equality check based on the number accessor of my two parameters and performing an equality test on there. And if not, I would just say that by default they're not equal. They're just that would yield false. And now I can try out what is actually happening if I compare my two natural objects over there, and it turns out that if I compare two naturals with each other, it would say true. Well, at least in this case, as I have constructed them with the same number. And the second case, where I construct a random object and compare it to a natural, it would just yield false. So that's kind of trying to simulate this object-oriented structure in a non-object-oriented language like this Clojure. And actually, you can do pretty funky things in this dispatching function. You don't even need to resort to something as simple as just constants for types. You can do even more creative stuff, like this one here, where I have just another multiply dispatched function, a dispatching function that would take the first parameter and try to compute a salary value on the wage of a person, and the salary function I've defined before, and this would be something that would kind of trying to try to evaluate what a certain number actually means. So if my amount is under 600, I would say that the person is poor. If it has an amount of larger than 5,000, that it would clearly be some kind of successful person, and everyone else would be an, well, this is short for assistant, because that's from the university. Yeah, well, anyway, we would then create different persons. This is a university person. This is, yeah, my colleague is gone now, but he's earning 4,000, which would be an assistant. Then there's the Hivi, which would earn 500, which is clearly poor. And then there's, of course, the boss, which would earn quite a lot. And the whole system then would actually fork to the, or dispatch to the relevant methods, which are these candidates here, which would, and the condition there would be that I would have different prints for poor, for assistant, and for the boss. Okay, so that's just a short preview of what Clojure actually can do. If you're interested in multiple dispatching, then that would be probably a nice way to try that out. Apart from that, I think we should quickly come to the end. Multiple dispatching, you get rid of this pronunciation of the privileged first parameter. You get a little bit of runtime overhead, but not too much. There's new exceptions that you get when you encounter the unclear situations of what to dispatch to, because in these cases, most specific method might turn out to be ambiguous, even in runtime. However, you can see multiple dispatching as being just a generalization of an already established technique, which is quite well known for its single dispatching. It directly solves a few problems that are out there and eliminates a lot of boilerplate code. And it's even compatible with modular compilation and type checking and all that. And there's a few languages who actually do that. And we have already seen Clojure, but there's also Dylan and Scala, which are able to do something like that. Anyway, there's a few things that we've seen today, and there's a few materials that you can query for that. And with that, I want to dismiss you for today, and we'll see each other on Thursday next week. Okay, then thank you, and have a nice week. Goodbye.